what do you take away from earnings?
Well, certainly investors were really concerned about an earnings recession, so the fact that we're beating is good, but we're seeing a lot of divergence too.
I would say that markets haven't reacted much to anything.
The European Union is set to delay Brexit. Officials have been meeting in Brussels considering Britain's request. While they have agreed to an extension, the length of the deferment will only be decided next week.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
We've got a good finish to the week this week. The market seems to like the fact that we have a high probability of a Fed rate cut coming next week. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me on the show will be Tom McClellan. He says everything is lined up for a good finish into the end of the year. He said this is the third year of a presidential election cycle. That tends to be good for the market, which is what we're seeing play out almost all of this year. We're basically reversing all of the negativity that we had in the fourth quarter of last year. Also joining me on the program will be Frank Holmes as we talk about the prospects for copper and gold. I know copper prices are weak, but copper is running a major supply deficit in places where it's produced. Production is falling either politically or mine problems, and that's going to be good for this new clean economy, green economy we're talking about, because all those electric cars you see on the road, guess what? They require copper. And Chris Prytower and myself will take a closer look under the hood. What does it look like for the economy and the markets over the next 12 to 18 months? And Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that in today's program.
As usual, the news seems to drive what's happening in the markets. We know that, for example, next week we have expectation of the Fed and a possible rate cut, but this week, Ryan, what do you see moving the markets?
Well, Chris, the earnings season kicked off to a good start last week, and that's led to this kind of charge of the bulls here this week. And by seeing earnings improve, and remember, we started off the season with, I think, a 4.6% estimated decline in growth for earnings. And so as companies are coming out and beating those expectations, we're seeing the discount of the value of equities move back up. So, and that's calming recessionary fears, right? Because we've had quite a few economic numbers over the past 2 months show that there may be some concerns for contracting of the manufacturing industry. And then we saw durable goods orders this week was also down. So again, some concerns with some of the economic numbers, but again, companies are laying that things are actually better than they look on paper on the economic side. But of the earnings this week, we had 12 Dow stocks, 12 Dow industrials report. And of those, about eight of them, we saw a very positive reaction by investors in bidding these prices up. And then there were only four where there wasn't as good of a showing. And these are for the bellwethers. That's, again, it's driving the bullish charge there. Now, let's look at monetary policy, because you said, you know, the Fed's going to be meeting next week, so we'd likely see what is the market expecting ahead of that, and are we starting to discount whatever that expectation is. So the next meeting will be next week on Wednesday. Actually, it's Tuesday and Wednesday, but they obviously give their policy decision on Wednesday. This week, the ECB left rates unchanged as expected, but they announced their $20 billion purchase program will go into effect November 1st, so that was kind of new. And we have the Federal Reserve, like I said, next week, and while I don't think they're going to lower rates. That's my own personal opinion. I just feel like it's just so close to the last one. What kind of message does that give? The Fed fund futures are predicting 93.5% chance when I last looked at it on Friday. That's highly likely. When you see rates that high on Fed fund futures, they're typically correct and right. But you know, we'll have to see how things go. The main reason I think why it's that high is because nobody some of the Fed speakers over the past couple of weeks before we had this kind of blackout period ahead of the meeting, nobody said it's off the table. Yeah, there were some reasons why some dissented, but again, there a couple of them saying, you know, every meeting is a chance to see policy shift here. You know, we may see the hawks that we've had dissent again, but obviously that doesn't mean that we can't see the rates lower. Low inflation and trade risks were at the heart of the rate cut in September. And while there's been this kind of handshake to do no more harm between China and the U.S., we have yet to have a significant trade progress, anything on paper. And, you know, again, things can change until it is. So that's why it is still very possible we could see a rate hike because, again, nothing has changed. So we'll have to see what happens. Concerning Brexit, has the market really reacted a whole lot to it? I think so from a foreign perspective, and maybe we can get into that. It appears that another delay is in the cards, so nothing quite new. There is uncertainty there. But again, yeah, that's nothing new. We've been delay after delay after delay. And there are some signs that economic recovery is improving abroad. We got the flash Purchasing Managers Index information this week ahead of the full one, which we'll get in a couple of weeks. But it showed that the U.S., the Eurozone, and Germany in particular, you know, we saw that 40 print at the for September was very concerning. Everything ticked up this month so far. So these are the flash readings mid-month. We'll get the final ones in a couple of weeks. Meanwhile, if you look at what's going on in currencies, some real interesting changes going on right now. The euro is strengthening. The British pound is strengthening on possibly on this maybe more of a resolution and agreement on Brexit, or maybe on economic activity, like I said, we're starting to see. But these currencies are mean reverting higher, and that's encouraging. And if you look at the MSCI, ACWI, we call it ACWI, it's a world index. Just broke out to a new 52-week high on Friday, possibly marking the break in the foreign equity consolidation we've been following for the past 2 years. Lastly, let's take a look at what else. The yield curve. You know, it's been steepening, and it's been a subject of continual conversation all throughout the last year. At the end of last year, the inversion of the yield curve. And think back in August or early September, I can't remember exactly when, the yield curve was totally inverted between the 2 and the 10 for a very brief period of time, and that marked the bottom. We've been seeing this spread increase, and that typically bodes very well for financials. And on top of the strength we've seen in financials from earnings and the yield curve steepening, that's calming the nerves of investors. And I don't know if you remember the interview I had with Craig Johnson last week. He said, the one thing you really need is the participation of financials. We've got it now. The one area that has been a problem for risk assets has been the software company performance in the U.S. as of late, so the last few weeks. But gains from earnings from Microsoft on Thursday helped stoke a rally there. That at the same time, we also got earnings from Lam Research that left just real strength in the technology sector to lead. And, you know, that's where the growth is in software, especially. We've definitely seen a minor shift. And Craig Johnson and I, again, talked about it last week of value outperforming growth stocks. And there you have it. You've got, you know, semiconductors and a few others. Energy actually did extremely well this week. And that's a what's considered a value group right now. The Philadelphia Semiconductor Index, you know, take a look at some of the things I've got here, hit a fresh all-time high on Friday as well. That bodes well for the bulls. And another area that has been weak for most of the summer was value. Like I said, energy has really improved. Materials has improved quite a bit. We're looking at copper is improving. But really, this also includes industrials and other cyclicals that are also improving. So a lot of, it seems like, you know, a lot of the growth areas, the areas you assume to be doing well in the business cycle when there's a recovery or expansion, you know, those are improving right now versus value, real estate, utilities, all these bond-like areas that had done well in the first three-fourths of the year.
That's a great summation of some of this week's catalysts and influences on what's led to the charge on record highs. Ryan, it would be of interest for our listeners to know what our investment team is doing to take advantage of the rotations that you're seeing. Is it out of growth and into value, possibly more rotation into foreign markets with the currency strength you're seeing there?
Definitely, but for us on the whole growth versus value, we're not really shifting our equity position too much internally between those two groups, but we are taking, if we're looking at interest rates going up or the spreads widening, we've actually lowered our allocation towards fixed income. But we've definitely increased our foreign exposure, and that was a major deal for us over the past few months. And we're now going in towards our maximum allocation towards that area. Whether we go even beyond that, I'm not quite sure yet, but we've definitely done something there. Baby steps, if you will, overall for our neutral towards maximum risk allocation. We did that this week, adding to our foreign exposure in a couple of other key areas, like some small cap, which is very well weighted towards financials. And actually, if you look at a lot of these foreign investments, like some of the ETFs out there that are broadly diversified, the ACWI index itself and a few others, very much financially oriented versus most of our indexes are oriented towards technology. So again, going back to those yields rising, spreads widening, starting to weight more on the financial side of things.
Well, I'm sure that's of value to our listeners to know that you're really paying careful attention to what's happening both here at home and abroad.
Yeah, well, we definitely are. We'll go towards maximum, complete maximum allocation towards risk in all of our portfolios if we start to see that better economic situation. You know, that yield curve is no longer inverted still. You know, it's only rightening out in the middle of it between the 2 and the 10. We still have very high short-term rates. More stimulus, which we are getting. So that's, again, leaning towards us moving now beyond neutral, and a clearer, more meaty deal between the U.S. and China. But we got a small headline Friday on that subject. The Treasury Office was saying that they're very close to finalizing the parts of Phase 1 deal. The Chinese early in the week said they're willing to do $20 billion in agriculture, and they'll go up to $50 if we, you know, shorten the tariffs or lessen them. Obviously, we've got that December 15th deadline still in place for consumer goods tariffs. So we still have some room to see some improvement, and that's why we're not quite at maximum yet.
Well, Ryan, thank you for that meaty read on what has moved the market this week. And once again, we do look forward to hearing another meaty read on the markets.
Yeah, next week will be exciting. We'll be talking about the Fed most likely. You know, did they cut? Did they not? And why? Has the language changed? I'm not anticipating any kind of language change a whole lot because, again, like I said, the situation really hasn't changed too much. We don't even have ink on the paper of that trade deal. So much to talk about next week.
Okay. Well, Ryan, thank you. We'll look forward to next week. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
This week, we had the pleasure of speaking with Peter Bukvar, Chief Investment Officer of Bleakley Advisory Group. He's also the editor of the Book Report. Last time we had him on our show, last quarter, he was spot on, saying that it looked like the global trade and global economic outlook was set to deteriorate further based on a number of global proxies that we discussed, and that we were starting to see the services side of the economy get dragged down by the manufacturing. That's what he said last quarter. That's exactly what we've seen over the past 3 months. So he gave us an update on FS Insider this week, and you're definitely going to want to hear what he has to say, especially when it comes to corporate buybacks. So he's making a big call that we have likely seen the peak in corporate buybacks this cycle. And that's very important because if that's true, then that means that's a major source of demand for the stock market that will no longer be there or no longer be as strong as it was in the past. So you'll definitely want to hear what he had to say this week on FS Insider. And here's a clip of what he had to say on that point.
I think one of the interesting aspects of the fourth quarter decline in the stock market was those companies with the highest net debt to EBITDA ratios, they got hit the hardest. I felt that with a potential shift to paying down debt, focusing on firming up your coverage ratios, that there would be less stock buybacks. And the 2018, we'll look back and that will mark the peak in stock buybacks. And I do think that is playing out, and that companies are focused more on their balance sheets. I mean, you listen to company conference calls, and it seems that every company is telling you what their debt to EBITDA ratio is, which for years, I don't remember ever hearing them talk about it unless it was a credit call. So I think between that and now the slowing economy and falling CFO and CEO confidence indices, well, if you're less confident, then you're going to be less aggressive in buying back stock and you're going to harbor your cash more.
So if you'd like to hear this full interview with Peter Bukvar or any of our other guest expert interviews airing 3 days a week during the week, you can go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Did you know that municipal bonds can provide you with a predictable source of income that is free from both federal and state income taxes? If you're in a high tax bracket, municipal bonds could be the right investment choice for you.
If you have more than $500,000 to invest, our portfolio managers can create a municipal bond portfolio designed to align with your financial goals. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939 now and add tax-free bonds to your portfolio. That's 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
The market has been going sideways with a lot of cross currents. Is a trade deal going to happen? Corporate earnings have been coming in on the missing side. What does this mean for you as an investor? Joining us on the program is Tom McClellan. Tom, let's begin with the top. As you look at the market up at the 40,000 foot level, what does it look like to you?
It looks very exciting to me. I'm very bullish going into next year. Yes, we've been going sideways in the summer and early fall. That's exactly normal. It's exactly what the market is supposed to do. Remember, sell them in, go away. Well, yeah, but the last part of that is, and remember to buy in October to catch the next up leg. So we're at that point now, and it's starting. We're seeing gobs of strong breadth numbers, meaning that advances minus declines are strongly favoring the bulls. So that's a sign that liquidity is plentiful. The Fed is putting its thumb on the liquidity scale with another $60 billion of don't call it QE. And so there's lots of money available to lift stocks. We just got to get past whatever's worrying everybody at the moment.
You know, it's interesting because the Fed shrunk its balance sheet by over $600 billion. But if you take a look at the latest message, they're going to pour that right back as they're going to be buying, what, $60 billion worth of treasuries every single month going into the second quarter of next year. So the liquidity is coming back into the market. Tom, I want to talk about two graphs that you sent me. Let's talk about them, and we're going to put them up on the website for our listeners. The first one you gave us was the presidential cycle pattern, and you've got a point of the second year and the third year, and you got a note, this was not on script. Explain that.
Well, just to start off, the presidential cycle pattern takes the S&P 500 data, we chop it up into four-year chunks of time, and then we average them together to get a depiction of what the average performance and the average behavior at every point is along the way during the four-year presidential term. And it's been a great tool. I've been using it since 1994 when I first synthesized it, and I update it for as we get more data. The big peak that we saw in October of 2018 was not on schedule, and the market was doing something different from what the script said. And then the big drop into the December 2018 bottom was also not on schedule. So the market seems to have balanced out its error by it veered one way and then it oversteered the other way. It went from one side of the road to the other side of the road, but now it's back on track again and correlating very nicely with the presidential cycle pattern. By that, I mean that not only is the direction of the overall trend correct, but the dance steps are there and on schedule. The up and down wiggles that are part of the minor part of the pattern, those are right on schedule. We're here in October of the third year of a presidential term, about to end of the fourth year. And I count those years, by the way, as starting November 1st instead of January 1st, because November is when the election is. So the election year that we're about to enter is generally an up year, especially when you have a first-term president. It's much more likely that the election will be an up year. And we're seeing confirmation of that in terms of the strong breadth numbers and uptrends, and I expect a breakout in the S&P here very soon.
The third year generally looks pretty good. Every president wants the market humming and the economy when they're running for re-election. Tom, what does the fourth year look like? And the only reason I'm bringing that up, we had the inversion of the yield curve. You have some people talking about a global slowdown, a possible recession. What do fourth years tend to look like if we're now back on track?
Well, you're asking a good question, and you're correct in pointing out that third years are generally bullish. And the reason that happens is that when a new guy gets elected president, he typically spends the first 2 years discovering that, oh my gosh, everything is worse than I told you it was before, and that the only solution to all of our problems is whatever he's trying to pass through Congress, whether it's tax hike or tax cut or big social program or whatever, that's the only solution that's going to lift us out of. Well, people get bummed out when they hear that things are worse than they were supposed to be and that the only solution is more government. Generally, that that activity gets done in the first 2 years, so that during the second half of the presidential term, the guy who's in office can run around the country declaring victory and saying, see how I told you I could fix everything. Look at how wonderful it is now. Well, people, when they're hearing that things are wonderful and there's not some big new owner's program that's going to throw them off kilter, they get more optimistic. And so the third year is generally an up year. Even in 1987, with the crash, the third year was still an up year. The crash just wiped out almost all of the gains prior to that point. So here we are, we're in the third year. Election years are a little bit more iffy because we get to have the fear of the unknown again. We don't know how the election is going to turn out, even though it probably won't matter for the stock market how the election is going to turn out, because presidents don't really have that much to do with what the economy does, but people think they do. And so we get all excited about what the election is going to be and what it's going to mean for our portfolios and what should we do. And that makes people more reluctant to buy in an election year than they were in the third year. But it's still generally an up year. And I expect that we're going to follow the script now, because we weren't following the script all that great during President Trump's first 2 years. But the market is following the script really nicely now, and I expect it to continue.
Okay, so let's talk about not following the script, because one of the things we saw last year is we saw interest rates spike to 3.25. In time, they've come down by 50%, as we're now around 1.7%, 1.8%. So let's talk about interest rates and following this script.
Well, do you want to talk about short-term rates or longer-term rates?
Long-term rates.
There's still a lot of demand for long-term treasury bonds, the 10 years and the 30 years. There's from the financial markets, there are a lot of boomers who are retiring and seeking safety in a sure thing. And so they're putting their money into bonds, as they were instructed to do for the last 40 years. Of course, they're all trying to crowd into that trade at the same time. And so that's pushing up bond prices and pushing down rates. And that's going to be with us for a little while. And we don't have inflation creating a problem that's saying that the yields are too low for the inflation rate. I expect that we will start seeing inflation picking up over the next 20 years or so. There's a 60-year cycle in long-term interest rates. And we're now in 10 years into the ascending phase of that, meaning interest rates are supposed to go up from 2010 to 2040. Interest rates have been hanging out down really low for longer than they should, and that likely means that they got some payback to do. So between now and 2040, I wouldn't want to be a long-term holder of treasury bonds. But a lot of other people do, so that's why we're still seeing the very low rates.
So if rates, and of course, the Fed is widely expected to cut interest rates again, and of course, now they're pouring liquidity to the tune of almost $60 billion a month. So some people call it QE light, whatever you want to call it. So Tom, if we were to go off script again, or if there was anything that was to happen that wasn't expected, like we've seen in the last 2 years, which did not follow the script, what would that be going forward?
Well, to start off with what you said, the Fed is expected to cut rates, and they should cut rates. One of the charts I sent you compares the two-year Treasury note yield to the Fed funds target rate, which is what the FOMC sets. They set the target rate, and then the New York Fed has a job of trying to make sure that the overnight repo market hits that target rate according to what the FOMC dictates. When we get into trouble is when the two-year yield and the Fed funds rate get too far apart. If the Fed would just outsource decision-making on interest rate policy to the two-year note yield, we would have much fewer and less volatile bubbles. We'd also have much more muted recessions and depressions. Right now, the Fed funds target is still about a quarter a point above the two-year note yield. And so if the Fed wants to get to neutral, they need to drop another quarter point, and then they'll be neutral. They won't be fueling it too much. They won't be stimulative. They'll just be neutral, and that'll be just right. So if any Fed members are listening, drop another quarter point, because the two-year note told you, and the two-year note knows better than you do what you ought to do. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to do what they ought to do.
You know, Tom, it always amazes me that they keep making these same kind of mistakes. If you take a look at 11 out of the last 12 recessions were preceded by Fed rate hikes. At least we can say this year, they were very hawkish going into last year. We got that major downturn in the quarter, and they immediately did a 180 and went from being hawkish to, well, we're going to sit back, and then now they're cutting rates. So you always wonder why they don't have somebody with a market background or trading background working at the Fed to help them in their thinking.
They did react quicker this time but in starting to cut rates than they usually do. It wasn't quick enough, but it was quicker. And the reason that they don't have market-based people helping them is that they all have very expensive PhDs and economics degrees. And what the market says is different than what they were taught in school. And what they were taught in school cost them a lot of money. It was a very expensive education. It must be a good education, and it must be right, and we just need to wait for it to be right. They don't use the scientific method very much in economics, where they test their hypothesis against what actually happens. But that's the nature of economics and the people who practice it.
Well, let's get into the weeds a bit when we're looking at the market. If you look at the sectors that have been dominating the S&P this year, they continue to be, Tom, more of what we consider the safety trade, things like staples, utilities, REITs, maybe with the exception of technology. That trend looks to me like it still remains in place. Do you see any change there or any rotation that would be on the horizon if what you think is going to unfold in the next year happens?
Yeah, you're talking about a preference that investors are having toward what they perceive as safer investments. Whether they're safer or not, let's set that question aside. It's the perception that matters for this discussion. And yes, they've been doing that. And they've had good reason, because every other week we get a new tweet about how we're almost having a deal with the Chinese, or now we're going to tighten sanctions on the Chinese, and now we're going to tighten sanctions on Turkey. Oh, no, we've got a peace victory declared. You know, it's back and forth and back and forth. People don't know how to react to this. It could turn on a dime and get people interested in more speculative investments, more consumer discretionary as opposed to staples, if, as it's speculated, that the U.S. signs a trade deal with China at the APEC summit. I'm not holding my breath on that one. But that's what would relieve people from that particular worry. They could still have lots of other types of worries, but that would be one worry that could be down if that were to happen. It doesn't look like it's leaning that way, according to the betting markets that I'm seeing.
You know, Tom, as you're looking at this, I can't remember, you know, it doesn't matter what you think of President Trump or not. You would have to say he's been a little different than most presidents that we've had, because, you know, we've never had to deal with tweets, as you mentioned, which can change almost daily from one side of the road to the other side. It seems like the markets are focused on a lot of this headline news, which may be just temporary noise. As an investor, would you ignore that, or do you pay attention to it?
I like to pay attention to everything and keep what works. Jason Gepfert of sentimenttrader.com has done some interesting work tracking Trump's tweets on the financial markets. And he's only one guy. He's a sample size of one, but he makes for a pretty good contrary indicator whenever he's getting excited about how the Dow's going up or how it's not going. Jason has created a pretty fun indicator. And if you go check out sentimenttrader.com, his website, it may be posted there. That's pretty fascinating stuff. I like to take it all in. I watch CNBC all day, and I listen to what people are saying, and I start to worry when I hear too many people on the air who are agreeing with me. I take heart when I hear everybody saying the opposite of what I'm thinking. So, yeah, there's a lot of noise, and it's hard to filter past all of it and learn which to listen to and what not to. That's where experience comes in.
So, Tom, given the fact that we're in a presidential cycle, third year probably being one of the best, and it's certainly proven that way to be this year, we basically have gained back everything we lost in the fourth quarter. The fourth year generally tends to be a good year for the market. So if you were speaking to investors, what would you be telling them to do right now?
You're right. The fourth year is generally a good period for investing. And the first part of that fourth year, from November to around May, which is what we're starting now, is the best part of that period. As we get closer to the election, people get more iffy. The market gets more sideways. There's a lot more doubt and worry. But as the fourth year is kicking off in November, it's a very strong seasonal period. And I'm expecting that seasonality to work very well this time. It's working. The comparison, the annual seasonal pattern is correlating very well, which says that there's good behavior. The market's doing what it's supposed to do. It's what it's expected to do. And so people can count on that more than if it's not behaving right. Don't give up hope just because you hear that the market's overvalued or that there's this problem or that problem. The breadth numbers are telling us that liquidity is strong, and that's a very favorable condition.
Yeah, and might point out, versus last year when the Fed was contracting its balance sheet, it raised interest rates four times. It looks like this year they could be lowering interest rates maybe three, maybe four times, and now they're pouring money and liquidity back into the markets, which is supportive of much of what we've been talking about. Tom, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so. You guys put out a lot of material.
Yeah, if you Google Tom McClellan, you'll find us. But our website is mcoscillator.com. It's a contraction of the McClellan oscillator, the indicator that my parents developed 50 years ago, back in 1969. My mother passed away, but my dad is still working with me and still doing great. We have a fun working relationship together. We publish a twice-monthly newsletter together, the McClellan Market Report. We also publish a daily edition every day that the market trades. You can find samples of those at the subscriptions tab on our website at mcoscillator.com.
All right, Tom, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Thanks for coming on and having yourself a great weekend.
Good weekend to you, Jim.
Bye-bye.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
So overall, the consumer from a stress level is doing quite well. So we don't see a rise in bankruptcies. We don't see a rise in foreclosures. I know there's been some hubbub about the rise in credit card delinquencies for those individuals outside of the top 100 banks. We don't think that's something to worry about. We think the majority of them that are inside that top 100 banks will actually remain nice and low. I can't remember what the percentages. But then overall spending, if you do look across the board at some of the major items that are critical, not only to US GDP, but also to global GDP, things like air travel, things like credit card usage, food retailing, luxury goods, real estate, and then urban transport, which would be things like Uber and so on. All of these search items are rising after essentially seeing a lull in 2018.
So if you'd like to hear this full interview with Benjamin Breitholtz and aren't already a subscriber to FS Insider, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. If you have any questions about accessing our content through the website or through your mobile device, feel free to contact us by using the contact us button on our website.
One of the best things you can say about 2019, unlike last year, just about every asset has gone up. Bonds have gone up, stocks have gone up, and in certain cases, commodities. Joining us on the program is Frank Holmes. Frank, I want to begin our discussion as we always do. Let's take a look at the gold markets right now. Gold is up for the year. Recently, it's pulled back a little bit. So let's begin with gold. What's your take here with so many of the sovereign debt outstanding is in negative territory?
Well, the important thing to hear to recognize is a very strong inverse relationship to real negative interest rates. And what does that mean? It means, what is the government going to try to seduce you with to buy their bonds minus the CPI number? So if you look at five-year government bonds or 10-year and you take away the CPI number, is that a positive rate of return or a negative? That is what a real interest rate is. And when gold hit 1900, real interest rates for 10-year government bonds in the U.S. hit minus 300 basis points. And then they rallied to plus 200, almost 300 basis points, a 600 basis point swing. And that's what took gold down to 1,000. And then immediately it popped back up. And so recently this year, we're seeing more going to negative real interest rates in the U.S. has gone and the rest of the world. What's also interesting is the overall percentage of government bonds that are negative. So it peaked in August. August the 28th was the greatest percentage of the G20 countries, which were providing, offering you a negative real interest rate on their government bonds. And that was the highest in the price of gold. Now, subsequent to that, the rates have sort of peaked back up. They're still basically negative. And the price of gold is sold off and is corrected. And I'm a big believer that this is just a normal cycle, that gold has this big rally going into September. It peaked a little earlier this year, and then it sells off in October, and then we get the big rally going again. So I may remain from that very positive and constructive. I would say that to your listeners that prior to 2008, the G20 finance ministers are acting like OPEC. Even though it's illegal in the U.S., they conduct themselves like a cartel. And they were totally consumed with global trade and economic activity. And since 2008, starting in 2009, they became totally consumed with synchronized taxation and regulation. And that's a big paradigm shift in the flow of funds. We have a war of China on trade, but we've had a war on money for a while now. And you're seeing it with the cost of anti-money laundering laws in the past 18 years has gone up dramatically from $1 billion a year to $3 billion a month now globally. And the ability that we used to have in our mutual funds, people from outside of the country can invest them, no longer that's allowed. So the flow of money itself has had its own sort of trade war, and now we're seeing it in that economic engine, and a lot of that has to do with the G20, and why I'm trying to explain this is so important, is that the G20 countries do not want to go to streamlining regulations or lowering taxation. They're trying to do it with cheap money. They're trying to stimulate economic growth by basically saying, here, money is free. And that has its inherent flaws, and that makes real assets from art to gold to real estate show spectacular performance. And if you look back long term for the past 20 years, the best performing asset class has been REITs. Number two is bullion. And then we take a look this year, REITs and bullion have also done exceptionally well.
Frank, continuing with that thread, increased regulation, increased taxation, cheap money, debasing the currency. But it's also carried over here, too, as well, not just the trade war, because if you look at the presidential election, we're talking about, you know, I call it the election, lots of free stuff that other people pay for, free housing, free education, free student loans, annual guaranteed income, expansion of Medicare for everybody. Isn't this basically expanding that same concept, but now it's hitting the U.S.?
Yeah, I'd like to add to that comment. You know, one of the things that President Trump is so worried about, illegals coming across the border, but legally what's been coming across the border that's most dangerous are EU socialist policies. And that's what's really led to Brexit. And they're so clever. They sugarcoat everything. I wrote a piece on this a couple of weeks back. And if you go back into when the slavery ships were coming across the Atlantic, they had words for the names of the ships like Hope and Liberty. Like, I don't think so. All right. And just like the Patriot Act wasn't very patriotic, how many rights you lost. And we can go on with some word choices. So now they're talking about harmonization of regulation and taxation really means they're trying to force America to raise their taxes and regulations to that of the EU. And if you really want to look at it flying at 50,000 feet, my opinion is this has been a big part of Brexit. The reason for the pushback, the anti being with the EU is because the EU has crushed the London Stock Exchange. There's a formation of capital. It was number two in the world behind New York. They've just burdened manufacturers of beds, chairs, whatever, in England. And so this is a pushback against the socialist mindset. And when you go over there and working, it's so expensive. It really shocks you how expensive it is. And the average person, a young waiter was telling me in Milan, from New York, and he went over there because he had a new baby, and he can't get paid more than $1,200 a month. And in Italy, they took off a line item where you can tip someone. So they don't think it's fair that you get a tip for good service. And so it's very difficult to make ends meet. So everyone's basically hand to mouth. But that's the model of Europe.
Well, Frank, when you take a look at that historically, when you get high taxation, high regulation, debasement of the currency through cheap money, traditionally that has been an inflationary force, and that's been positive for gold.
It has, you know, and I think that gold is doing what I think it's important is to do, and there's all those other factors, like I mentioned before, that we're experiencing peak supply, and so we're going to see that supply from gold mining is going to decline, and I think that that's another important part. in this whole equation. And I also like that what I've really noticed is the Bank of International Settlements, which I never really paid a whole lot of time and effort on, but I really saw, Jim, what they did with Bitcoin, how aggressive and anti they were everything on Bitcoin. It just wasn't rational to me that the head of the Bank of International Settlements was everywhere speaking on and on and on. And then I did some additional work with it and find out that they're involved with all the gold swaps. And basically, they are the clearinghouse for 60 banks around the world. And they care more about a worthless piece of paper out of Venezuela than they do the preservation of someone owning gold or owning a Bitcoin. So I think that that's sort of like, it's so easy to see the war on the Bitcoins of the right now in the overall, but it's much more stealth to see, but it's still against gold because they're continuous with their paper money printing. But eventually, it all of a sudden, it snaps. You know, the great hedge fund manager George Soros called it, that it goes a quantum leap. It just happens, and it goes exponential. And then all of a sudden it goes on baselines along a new reset button. And I think that that's what I've written about. And I've talked that I think you can see gold at $10,000 now. And I don't think you need to have the world's coming to an end. I think there's going to be a reset button with this sort of refusal to deal in streamlining regulations around the world and lowering taxes. And the battle really is citizens against governments that are looking for taxing to run their big governments.
You know, Frank, on the day you and I are speaking, Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook is before Congress. Both parties really hostile towards him, and especially his idea of coming up with a cyber currency called the Libra. I mean, he was really getting hammered on that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and that's the whole thing why the Bank of International Settlements, they don't want to crypto money because they want to control the paper. They want to control against their socialist policies and how they coordinate. And so I think it's interesting that the Bitcoins of the world, they all sell off into these meetings. If you look in the past 18 months, big sell-offs every time there's a meeting with Congress or the Senate or the SEC hearings, and then we get a bounce back up. So there's a lot of sentiment in that space. But what Zuckerberg is doing is it scares the banks. And you can see the moral suasion in the Federal Reserve getting the MasterCards, the Visa, everyone not to support it, and PayPal, and for it, because it really is an incredible threat to them because he has so much data. And with AI today, on his customers, and he has 2 billion. He has data on 2 billion people around the world. And but what happens if that crypto coin, as Steve Forbes wrote to Zuckerberg and said to him, please, well, why don't you have 20%, I believe it was 20% behind each of these, the new coin, the Libra, be gold. And that would be the reset button for the rest of the world. Well, if that was to happen, gold's going to be $5,000.
Wow.
But coming back on it, I think it's really important to watch the concern by so many regulators, because they want to control that and they don't have that access that he has. And so I think there's going to be a wrestling, but I think the crypto space is going to continue to grow. And the other one is, remember, J.P. Morgan paid people to say negative things, economists, about Bitcoin. They trash-talked it all the way down to 3,000, and then this year they came out in February with their own coin, and that was the bottom in Bitcoin. And Bitcoin then climbed to 8,000, and then Facebook came out and talked about they're not going to have a coin, and it went to 14,000. And then every regulatory body went after it, and then it sold off to under 8,000. But there's something that's really important to recognize, is that this digital money is for real, and it's a wrestling match between governments trying to control it.
I want to switch gears quickly and talk about another metal that's used every single day, and that is copper. Copper has been hitting lows because of concerns about global growth. But Frank, we're running annual supply deficits in copper. And if we're moving towards electric cars, I mean, the average Tesla has 130 pounds of copper. We're going to be consuming more copper. All this high tech and clean energy stuff that we're talking about consumes copper. What's your take on copper here? Because it's in the doldrums despite huge supply deficits that are growing every year.
You know, it's one of the most crowded short trades. And I think that what's important for the listeners is that we write about it every month when, when the global PMI, that is Purchasing Manufacturers Index, comes out. We write it and we analyze the China versus Europe, Germany, France, and we do regressional studies on how predictive it is. So if the 1 month is above the 3 months or the 1 month is below the 3 months, how does it impact copper, steel, oil? And why is that important? Because PMI is a 6 month leading indicator. So if you get a big order to make copper motors with copper, then all of a sudden, the manufacturer PMI starts to pick up, and you're going to consume a lot of energy to make those motors. And so that's why, and it's going to take at least 6 months to deliver those motors. That's why it's a good leading indicator. And it started about 18 months ago turning south, and then as the trade wars accelerated, then the PMIs of Europe have fallen below 50. China fell below 50, came back up, but the world is very precarious at this stage. But any settlement with trade in China that's meaningful, the PMIs go 1 month above the 3 months, copper can jump 40%. And reason for that is because everyone is short. The demand is there, like you're talking about. We're running into a deficit. And also, all you have to do is have the problems like Chile. You have a crisis in Chile, and that's another classic case study where the government took away benefits for tax break for fuel. The people said, I'm going to have to pay more for my fuel. They ride in the streets. They burn things. And the government could have simply said, yeah, we're going to give you a payroll tax, so it's not going to come out of your pocket. But oh, no, the government's not going to do that there. They're going to take it because they've got their own agenda of building their own government. And so you get this turmoil that people are getting very upset about the government reaching into their pockets. And I think that this is a classic example. Supply of copper all of a sudden can't leave the country, and copper starts to have a pop.
So, Frank, given where the markets are right now, and especially gold looks like it's in a consolidation phase, what would you tell investors to be doing? I love copper, but what about gold and copper right now?
Well, copper, BHP is one of my biggest holdings in global resources. And one of my best specs, you know, optionality, is Copper Bank. It's a little tiny penny stock, and Gianni has wrote in a book, the CEO on copper, drove his Tesla all across America, and he's basically has over 10 pounds of copper, you know, over $10 of copper behind every share. And that's a big number, you know. So you're buying for optionality. And when the PMIs do turn positive, because they always do, and copper starts this surge, then stocks like that can go up 5 or 6 fold. So we own things like that in addition to BHP.
All right. Well, Frank, if our listeners would like to follow, you're a very prolific writer. How could they do so?
Well, go to usfunds.com and sign up for Investor Alert and Frank Talk, and take a look at our ETFs. We talk about the idea of using data sets to analyze companies, etc. Well, we created GoAU, which is a gold equity ETF. We spent 8,000 hours doing the regressional work on it, and it's outperformed the GDXJ. And models said it would outperform over 90% of the time. And since we launched it in the past 2 years, it's done that. And it's outperformed all the active gold fund managers. So I think you'll learn more about the quant metrics of looking at picking stocks, in addition to the macro forces, by signing up at usfunds.com for Frank Talk.
All right, Frank. Well, listen, as always, pleasure having you on the program. All the best.
All right. Happy investing.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Do you find yourself reacting to market news, selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered. No matter what direction the markets take, we can help you protect your investments during market downturns and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Officials began discussions last month at the Fed when they cut their benchmark rate to a range between 1.75% and 2%, but the Fed is meeting next week. Now, Jim, usually the Fed cuts interest rates because bad things are happening in the economy, but it seems to be kind of a mixed bag of news. Do you think we're going to see another cut?
I really do. I mean, if you take a look at, Chris, the markets right now are anticipating, at least the futures market, is 90%. And whenever you get that high of a probability, the Fed is reluctant to disappoint the markets because they know what that means. It's going to be a big sell-off, and that's the last thing that they want. So right now, the probability is for a 90% cut in interest rates when they meet next week. What's interesting, about a month ago, that was only about a 40% probability, which is where we are when we look at the December rate cut possibilities. So right now, we think they're going to cut rates another quarter of a point, taking the Fed funds rate down to 1.5 to 1.75. And if the economic data continues to weaken, which we'll get into shortly, look for the possibilities of a December rate cut to happen as well. So just like last year, they raised interest rates 4 times. If they cut again in December, they will basically undo everything they did in 2018 by cutting rates 4 times.
This is so interesting, Jim. And like you said, the probability has gone up like crazy from that 40% to 90% probability as of Friday when we're recording this. We're seeing the S&P 500 nearing record levels. In fact, it briefly went above its previous closing record of 3025, which was back in July 26. So, I mean, you look at the stock market, you look at Bloomberg's buying climate index, shows a very strong holiday season for retailers. What is the Fed looking at that makes them see that we need to cut?
Well, number one, growth has definitely decelerated. If you look at it globally, a lot of the PMIs, especially Germany's in a recession, Japan's slowing down, the ECB is cutting interest rates. So, Chris, you know, I don't care if you're looking at the World Bank, the IMF, everybody is talking about global growth slowing down everywhere you look. In the U.S., overseas in Europe, in Asia, China, global economies are slowing down. I mean, if we look at, for example, in the U.S., we had the ISM Manufacturing Index. That is basically slowing down. It's in what we call contraction territory for 2 months in a row. It's been heading down since the beginning of the year. It dipped below 50 in the month of August, down to 49.1. It dipped even lower in the month of September to 47.8. But on top of that, up until recently, the non-manufacturing index, which is the service sector in the U.S., that has been very strong. It was at 55 in June, 53 in July. It popped to 56 in August, but in September, it dropped down to 52. So if you look at all of these indicators, we almost have a bifurcated economy. We have basically 3 areas of weakness. We have a weakness in manufacturing that is now contracting with the index below 50. The other thing that we're starting to see is we have a weakness in housing. Housing is weakening even though we've got the lowest mortgage rates in probably a decade. But housing starts, resale homes, new homes, all of that slowing down. And what's interesting about that, Chris, it's slowing down. It's a reflection more of housing prices. Housing prices are up over 6% year over year. So even though interest rates are coming down, there isn't a glut of housing on the market. And also, housing just gets more expensive. So we really need to see rates come down. The other thing that is also hitting the economy is they're calling it peak auto. Auto sales peaked in 2017. They fell in 2018. They're down in 2019, and they're expected to go down in 2020. Now, that's a combination of rising prices, more environmental restraints placed on automobile manufacturers, which is being built in to the price of the home. So if you look at this economy, it's almost like a bifurcated economy. The consumers are doing pretty well. Consumer confidence is up. The stock market is up. Wages are up. All of that is good because 70% of our economy is based on consumption. On the other side of the coin, what is not looking as good is what we're seeing in manufacturing, the service sector slowing down, and then especially if we start to look at business investment. There's just too much uncertainty with this trade war right now for businesses to make any major decisions on building new plants. In fact, right now, a lot of businesses are saying if this trade war continues, it's going to disrupt global supply chains. You're going to see companies taking their factories or moving their factories out of China. They may be moving it to Vietnam, back here to the U.S. Apple's building factories in Phoenix. They're building factories in Austin, Texas. So there's basically two sides of this economy. The business side is where we're seeing the weakness, along with big ticket items like buying homes and housing, which is also weak.
There definitely is some news that shows storm clouds. For example, global economic growth has slowed to its lowest pace since the 2009 recession, according to the IMF. But Jim, I want to go back to the Fed for a moment, because today, again, at the time of this recording, Friday, the Fed bought $7 billion in treasury bills to increase its balance sheet. And it also added $77 billion in liquidity into financial markets today. How does that affect what we're seeing on the economic front, but also how does that relate to the coming cut?
Well, if you take a look at what's going on, as I discussed earlier, the Fed is almost basically redoing everything they've done in the last year, including quantitative tightening. If you take a look at, they're going to add about $60 billion of T-bill purchases going all the way up to the end of the second quarter of next year. So, Chris, they're basically going to increase their balance sheet by almost $600 billion, which is what they shrunk it by. So if you look at the T-bill buying that they're going to be doing from now until the second quarter of next year, if you're looking at possible 3 or 4 rate hikes, they're basically unwinding or undoing everything they did last year, replacing 4 rate hikes with 4 rate cuts, replacing $600 billion reduction in their balance sheet with $600 billion of T-bill purchases. In fact, it's estimating if they continue at $60 billion a month, they will own between 12 to 15% of all outstanding treasury bills. So that is providing, as Tom McClellan and I talked about in the first part of the show today, they are providing this liquidity to the market. Because if you look at stocks going up right now, they're not doing it because of earnings, because earnings are going to be down about 4 or 5% this quarter, and this will represent the third consecutive quarter of falling earnings. What's driving this market is PE expansion, and what we have going for us now, at least for the stock market, is global liquidity. The Fed is injecting liquidity into the financial markets. They don't want to see the disruption that we saw in September, where in a single day, basically, the repo rate spiked from 2% to 10%. So they're wanting to make sure there's enough cash in the system that ordinary business and trading takes place without any disruptions or interest rate spikes as we saw last month.
Well, how does the trade war fit into this? Because I'm wondering if there seems to be just so much uncertainty still when it comes to that. I was reading that the Bank of Italy governor, Ignazio Visco, he said in an interview that it's very difficult to understand whether there is a strategy or it's a series of acts, some of them not really well thought out or coordinated. And one thing we know is that the markets don't like uncertainty. So do you feel, Jim, that the United States and China, for example, will be able to sign a lasting deal in the short run that could give markets some sort of certainty?
It looks like they're going to make some kind of agreement, whether, you know, it's Trump holding off on the tariff increases, China buying more agricultural goods. But we've got a long ways to go. And, you know, China is playing this from a political point of view. You know, they're looking and hoping that, hey, they get a different president when it comes to the fall of next year, because no president has been tougher on China than Trump. Most other presidents basically let China do whatever they want. So there's still going to be that uncertainty, and that is really what is holding back capital investment by business. I mean, you know, if you know this trade war is going to continue into next year, and especially if Trump wins a second term, this could get even tougher for China. So right now, Chris, the uncertainty that we're seeing in the economy, I think we'd be growing at 3% if it wasn't for the trade war instead of 2%. The San Francisco Fed issued a paper, and they said that the trade war has knocked off about 0.8% off U.S. GDP growth. So right now, if you're a business, what are you going to do? Your supply chain is global. You may have plasma screens made in South Korea. They're shipped to China. They're put on a boat and shipped to Los Angeles. That's what businesses are waiting for, is some kind of clarity and certainty. And I don't think that's going to get resolved here in the next couple months. We may hold off on tariffs. The rhetoric may get a little bit nicer. And maybe we reach some kind of tentative short-term agreement. But the long-term aspects of this trade war have much further to run. And I think that's what businesses are sensing, which is one reason they're reluctant to spend money.
And you had made mention of the housing market and signs that things aren't looking good with housing. One thing I was noting here is that if you look at mortgage rates, very, very low, but then conversely, you look at how high home prices are. Does this spell storm clouds that maybe are bigger than they appear? Because the median sales price for an existing home last month was $272,000, which is up almost 6% from a year earlier. But the supply of homes on the market declined 2.7% from a year ago. So it seems like an unbalanced situation. Do you think this could really be an issue?
I really do. And unlike the housing boom in the last economic cycle, this time builders have been circumspect. You've got all kinds of zoning regulations that are making it more difficult and adding to the cost of building, especially here in California. And you know what? Builders just, everything's going up, Chris. Wages are going up, materials are going up, and that's factored into the price of housing. And because they're not overbuilding, there is sort of a shortage of supply. In other words, if we had more homes on the market, the prices wouldn't be going up as much as they are. So the problem is not on the demand side. The problem is on the supply side, which is driving prices up. And of course, interest rates have not come down that much to make it more affordable. If you look at the affordability index, the price of homes, the cost of financing, and I don't see that changing. It may change on the high end of the markets here in California. On the high end of the markets, you're seeing the big McMansions drop in price. There was a recent celebrity sale in La Jolla where the price of the home dropped by $10 million. But that's on the high end as California experiences an exodus of millionaires because of the tax rates and all the other things that are going on in California. But I see this thing in housing continuing well into the future.
Well, earnings are slowing. They're down year over year. I think you're making a strong case for there being concern. Do you think, Jim, is it too early to say the R word? Do you think that there's risk of recession?
Chris, I really don't see a recession. In fact, some people might call it a growth recession, where the economy grows at 2% or less, maybe in the 1% to 2% range. There isn't really one of the biggest things that has happened that's probably reversed the probability of recession is what the Fed did when it pivoted in January. I mean, they were sounding hawkish last year. QT was on automatic pilot. They were far away from neutral. They were forecasting 3 to 4 rate hikes again this year. And then all of a sudden, the first couple of weeks of the year, they pivoted and say, oh, we're going to hold back a little bit. And then all of a sudden, they start talking about cutting. And already they've cut twice. They're going to cut probably next week. And a high probability they'll end up cutting for the fourth time in December. Then on top of that, they were shrinking their balance sheet, which was removing liquidity of the market. Now they're reversing that. In the next 9 months, they're basically going to reverse all the tightening or shrinking of their balance sheet that they did over 12 months. So a major risk to the market has been removed. And like I said, right now it's a bifurcated economy. It's looking very good on the consumer end, wages, unemployment, wage increases. I mean, there's more jobs than there are people to fill them. So as long as that remains, unless there is just a major, major shock that nobody could see, for example, a real spike in the price of oil that lasts more than just, let's say, a week or two, like it did when the Iranians bombed that Saudi facility. Outside a major, major shock, I just don't see a recession.
we've looked at a number of factors. We talked about the Fed. We've talked about the likelihood, the strong likelihood of them cutting. We've talked about global PMIs, the Fed buying T-bills, the slowdown with housing and autos. But what does it all mean for investors?
You know, Chris, just like Tom McClellan said, we are in the third year of a presidential cycle, which is the best that the market does. And we're seeing that this year, but also the fourth year. So assuming the Fed cuts interest rates, it supplies liquidity into the market, which it plans on doing all the way into the second quarter of next year, the markets should have a fairly good year. But I think what you're going to see next year is you're going to see more volatility, whether it's the impeachment hearings. And oh my God, just plan on probably seeing the most ugly political campaign you've ever seen in your life next year. And that will create uncertainty in the market. What some candidate's going to do, how much they're going to raise taxes, they're going to break up tech companies, whatever the rhetoric comes out of political campaigns, that will create uncertainty too. For example, if we go to a single payer healthcare system, that will cause nervousness with drug stocks or insurers and things like that. So you're probably going to have a lot more headline risk next year as a result of politics more than anything else. We still have Brexit and we'll still have the trade war. So those are the big three. And then we also have the Middle East. So throw in four, which should make for some headline risk going into the markets next year. But given the fact the Fed's providing liquidity, global central banks are cutting interest rates, it should be another good year for investors.
Well, Adam Rosenzweig on our October 16th FS Insider said that commodities are at their cheapest levels in 100 years. How's gold looking right now?
You know, gold is looking good, just like Frank Holmes and I talked about. We've got negative interest rates. In fact, almost a third of sovereign debt outstanding is negative interest rates. Just imagine as an investor, you loan a company money or you loan a government money. Instead of getting interest in return, you actually pay them interest. So negative interest is very positive for gold, and I expect gold to head much higher, not only over the next 12 months, but over the next couple of years. So gold should be, in my opinion, part of every portfolio is sort of like an insurance policy. A lot of the experts we have here on the program don't recommend more than 5 to 10% be kept in gold, but I think it's going to be a good time for gold.
Well, we've talked about the Fed, and obviously that's going to be big news for next week. Anything else that you see coming up, though, in the weeks ahead?
No, I think it's just going to be headline risk on the political front, trade war, impeachment, and now there's a new criminal investigation into what happened with the Russia thing. So that's been launched or going to be launched with a possible grand jury. So a lot of political theater that could throw some curves at this market. But right now, we're in the middle of earnings season. It looks like a lot of these companies are missing earnings. On the positive side, liquidity is flowing back into the markets again, so should keep markets elevated going into next year. So in the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.